Setlist in association with 7Digital.
This week, Massive Attack, banned songs and donuts. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. We're just back from the UK Music Christmas lunch. Now, as regular listeners of Setlist might remember, I don't drink, so I'm just very full because I ate a lot of turkey and I had two helpings of Christmas pudding. I would like to point out that Paul Scaife from Record of the Day pressured me into having the second Christmas pudding.
Well, that sounds very like Paul Scaife.
I wouldn't have just had double Christmas pudding on my own back. So I'm quite full and therefore...
No one at my end of the table ate Christmas pudding, except one person who arrived back from the toilet after all of the nice dessert had been served.
So they had to have Christmas pudding. It was a nice Christmas pudding. But my point is...
It looked nice, but I had the chocolate tart.
I'm quite tired, but Andy, I assume, is quite drunk.
Well...
So I think the tiredness can probably be edited out. I may yawn occasionally, but I'm pretty certain I'm not going to actually fall asleep. So any of the impacts of my tiredness, having had a very big lunch, we can get rid of in the edit. Whether or not we can get rid of Andy's drunken nonsense in the edit... Well, that'll be an interesting challenge.
Well, I'll be editing it.
You will be.
Drunk, so we'll see.
Both recording and editing drunk. Yeah, that's not going to... anyway, welcome to Setlist. This should be an interesting edition.
As ever, we're going to be taking a look back through some of the biggest and most interesting music business news stories of the last week. A week when Genius sued Google.
So this is a follow-on to a story we talked about on an earlier edition of Setlist. So you may remember this if you are a regular listener, that earlier this year it emerged that Genius, the website that was once known as Rap Genius, and it's a crowdsourced kind of wiki lyrics site where people aggregate lyrics, but then they comment on the lyrics and all of that sort of stuff. And earlier this year, Genius claimed that Google was stealing lyrics out of its database. Because these days, if you go to Google and you type in the name of a song in its search engine, as well as getting a link to where you can see those lyrics on Genius and a whole bunch of other websites, Google actually put the lyrics in what they call an information box at the top of the page.
Yes.
Which is a bit annoying for sites like Genius, because if it's the lyrics you're looking for, why would you then click through to go and read them on Genius when Google have presented them to you?
Yes, Google wants to keep you within Google, and I mean, it's doing a good job of doing that, which is a bad thing for any website that wants to serve up information to people, which is most websites.
And in this case, it's Genius. But not only are Genius annoyed that Google is doing that, they're even more annoyed that they reckon that some of the lyrics that appear in Google's information box have been nabbed out of Genius's database. And so they made this allegation earlier in the year. The news in the last 7 days is they've now actually gone legal on this. It's an interesting case in that it's not a copyright case. You might be thinking, oh, we're talking about lyric theft here.
Well, Genius doesn't own the lyrics.
No.
So what does it have a claim over?
Because the songwriters and all their publishers actually own the copyright in the lyrics. So they're not Genius's lyrics. They're not Google's lyrics. They're not even the lyrics of this company, Lyricfind, which are the other company that's mentioned in all of this, who are a lyric aggregator. They work with publishers. They aggregate lyrics and then they provide them to companies like Google. So it's not a copyright case. It's a slightly weird breach of contract case, which we won't get into now. But there is one really interesting element to this story, which we did talk about last time, although there's a little add-on, which is the way that Genius know, or pretty damn certain, as far as their lawsuit is concerned, they know this. The reason Genius knows that Google is taking lyrics out of its database, because, I mean, lyrics are lyrics. How do they know they're getting them from the Genius database and not from Lyricfind's database or from some other database? The reason they know is... About 18 months ago, they started on certain lyrics, strategically placing the apostrophes so that some apostrophes were curly and some were straight. And if you treat the curly apostrophes as being a dash and the straight apostrophes as being a dot, or possibly the other way around, it spells out the word red-handed in Morse code. So it's a nice little bit of sort of espionage and intrigue about this story. So this is how Genius worked out that Google were taking lyrics out of its database. So there was a lot of back and forth between Genius and Google. And then it all went public earlier this year in an article in the Wall Street Journal where Genius went public with these claims for the first time. And now it's gone legal. But the interesting thing is, since the Wall Street Journal article and the lawsuit that was filed last week, all of those lyrics that had the curly apostrophes, the apostrophes, the red-handed lyrics, stopped appearing on the Google platform. But Genius then had to ask the question, well, is that because they've stopped nabbing lyrics out of our database? Or is that because Google is now doing a find and replace on all the apostrophes in all of the lyrics that they publish? So they came up with another ruse, because, I mean, I'm sure you, well, you definitely were, most of our listeners were aware that in word processing and desktop publishing software, there are curly apostrophes and there are straight apostrophes. But what you probably didn't know was, not only are there different types of apostrophes, there are different types of spaces. So the spaces between words. And so what they started to do was having different sorts of spaces in the lyrics. And again, one sort of space was a dot, the other sort of space was a dash. This time it was spelling out the word genius. And those lyrics started appearing on Google again. Then they tried putting some lyrics up with both the apostrophes and the spaces. And what they were finding was, yes, Google was finding and replacing the apostrophes. They were no longer in there. So the combination of curly and straight apostrophes was no longer in there. But the sneaky spaces, they were. So I've no idea whether or not, legally speaking, Genius have a case here. Because I say it's not a copyright case. And I know LyricFind gave a statement to Billboard, I think, in which they said they hadn't actually seen the lawsuit at the point that they were giving the response. So they were just basing it on everybody's reporting of the lawsuit. But they were pretty adamant that they didn't think there was a case. So legal arguments aside, the most interesting bit of this story is the sneaky apostrophes and spaces, which is kind of genius.
Yes, LyricFind had said that when Genius had brought this problem to their attention, as a courtesy, they'd stopped checking Genius as a way of just confirming that their lyrics were correct in their database. But they were still checking other websites, and they thought that possibly the other websites that they were using were still pilfering lyrics from Genius, and maybe that was the problem.
I think we probably speculated last time we talked about this on Setlist, LyricFind has deals with lots of the music publishers. Mm. So the starting point for the lyrics in their database will be the music publishers. But A, this whole case confirms that we talked a lot about how the music publishing sector isn't always particularly on it when it comes to data. And that even includes the lyrics that they publish. So there are plenty of music publishers who don't have the lyrics that they publish and control. But also, it wouldn't surprise me if the people who are nabbing lyrics off Genius and then putting them into the LyricFind database aren't the publishers themselves. Some of whom probably have very junior members of staff who say, oh, we forgot to get the lyrics off the songwriter when we put this song out. Will you go and work out what the lyrics are? And they just Google and then they go off. And to be fair to Genius, when a new song is out there, brand new, it is often Genius who get the lyrics up first. So if you're like doing it around about release, there's a very high chance that they will be on the Genius site before anywhere else. So it may well be even that the music industry is pilfering the lyrics from the Genius database. So not sure about the substance of the lawsuit itself, but an interesting illustration of yet more issues around data when it comes to the music industry at large, and particularly on the publishing side, and then the entertaining ways in which Genius confirmed their suspicions. But this is not what we're here to talk about this week.
No, we are going to talk about songs being banned from the radio and songs being released in unexpected forms, such as donuts. But now we're going to talk about Massive Attack and their efforts to make their touring less environmentally harmful.
So yes, this was a big announcement from Massive Attack in the last week, which came hot on the heels. That's an expression, right? Hot on the heels. You can be hot on the heels. Don't be too hot on the heels, because it's all about global warming. We don't want there to be too much heat. But this
warm on the heels.
Warm on the heels. Cold on the heels. Cold being relevant. From Coldplay's recent announcement that they were not going to tour around their current album because they were concerned also about the environmental impact of them going around the world, particularly the flights. I think we discussed this before, how it's the flights are the really big, tricky part of trying to make touring once you go global environmentally friendly. So Chris Martin in the interview basically said, we're not going to tour this year. We're not going to tour this album. We're going to take time off from going around the world, and we're going to have a good think. We're going to think really hard about what it is that we could be doing to make our tour less environmentally damaging. Hey, maybe even that going on the road is beneficial to the environment. Massive Attack, I guess, are coming from the same place, but have come up with a different solution to the problem, a very different solution to the problem. an opposite solution to the problem.
Well, obviously, Coldplay's plan is to take time off to do the research, to work out how to tour in a more environmentally friendly way. But Massive Attack have realised that possibly the easiest way to do that research is to go on tour and take some climate scientists with you to analyse the data that that tour then throws up, and then maybe make a decision on how you can better reduce your impact on the environment.
Yeah, so Massive Attack, like Coldplay, in some of the quotes around what they announced recently, did talk about how they have been concerned for a number of years about when they go on the road, the environmental impact of that, and as I say, the flights, but other things as well, just getting the kit around and the power consumed at the shows. But yeah, so what they've said is, we are equally concerned, but what we have done is that we've formed an alliance with the University of Manchester, and we are now already collaborating with some climate experts, and we're going to get them involved in the tour, they're going to come on the tour, and they're basically going to use us as a massive experiment to try and test out possible ideas of how we might be able to make touring a little bit more environmentally sustainable. And very much with a view to then, you know, not keeping that to themselves, testing all of these things and then sharing that information in the hope that they can help other artists who possibly can't afford to take climate scientists on the road with them to start implementing measures that would make touring and performing live a little bit more environmentally friendly.
Yeah, so they announced that they were going to do this tour with climate scientists earlier last week. Then later in the week, they announced that they were going to do a super low emissions show in Liverpool sometime next year. They haven't said exactly when yet, but the plan is, I think, to take some of the data that they've pulled from their touring activity earlier in the year and put on a performance where they put some of what they found into practice and try to do some sort of kind of carbon neutral show as a pilot to show other artists how they could take that forward.
Yeah, and that show in Liverpool will be part of a bigger event that's happening in that city. Not a music event, it's called the Good Business Festival. So its slogan is that it aims to engage the power of business to affect positive change. And when they announced the show, there was a list of things that they're hoping to improve when it comes to the environmental impact of putting on shows. So they listed things like transportation. Obviously, we've talked about that a lot for both the band, but also for the crew and for all the equipment. Production power, catering options. So I don't know if that means no more meat.
Yeah, well, that's a big thing, isn't it?
Not all the factory farming, although I occasionally read articles that question that, but then I sometimes wonder if they're written by steak fans who just don't want the meat is killing the world thing to be true. Audience transportation. So, you know, what can you do beyond getting the band to the place? You know, and I don't quite know, obviously it's slightly out of your hands how audience get there. But I mean, that is something some festivals, I mean, Glastonbury in particular, but some festivals do, for example, try and bus people on site, don't they? So rather than everybody bringing their own car, you have a bus. Or maybe you try and make it super public transport accessible, really near stations or stuff like that. Maybe do a shuttle bus from the station to the venue to encourage more people to come back. I don't know what it is they're thinking about. Also, merchandising. Now, this is particularly interesting because every year in the spring in London, there is, I'm sure I've talked about this before on Setlist, there is a conference all about making events and festivals more environmentally sustainable. And,
yes.
And this event's gone on for years now, and I normally moderate a panel there. And I talk about it, I think, because it is one of my favourite conferences to be involved in, because I do lots of conferences these days. I talk at lots of events. They're all great. But this is the event where things are talked about, which I know nothing about. So rather than starting off the panel with my questions and being, I'm pretty certain what all my panelists are going to say, it's at that event where I am sitting down and it's like, well, I'm really, everything you say is going to be new to me. I'm really going to learn a lot about this. I think the one I always talk about is a few years ago, I did the toilets panel, how you have toilets on your festival site to make them as environmentally sustainable or least environmentally damaging, I guess. The key learning there was that solids are fine. We can deal with them on site in an environmentally friendly way. Liquids are the problem because you have to take them off site. So that was the toilets learning. But the reason why this is relevant, because they don't mention toilets in this list, maybe they should, maybe I'll email them and put them in touch with Glastonbury's head of toilets. She knew a lot about making toilets environmentally sustainable. But last year, my panel at this event was on merchandising and trying to make merch both environmentally sustainable and also fair trade, because obviously there are some environmentally sustainable options for merchandise. But then it's like, but you know, is anybody being exploited in the supply chain? And obviously with things like merchandise, there's, again, a transportation element to that, which is, you know, where is the fabric coming from? Where is the cotton coming from? And things like that. And some people have started doing hemp merchandise, and there are some reasons why that's more environmentally friendly. but not if the hemp's coming from America. So it's really interesting to know what they're planning around the merchandise, and then finally show sponsorship. So that's interesting.
Well, we've talked about that before with Neil Young,
yes,
when he refused to take part in Barclaycard British Summertime Festival in London because Barclaycard funded fossil fuel companies.
So that's a more obvious sponsor you might want to steer clear of if you're trying to have an environmentally responsible message. And obviously oil companies, car companies would be the obvious people to steer clear of. But I mean, I think there are other companies too where... Well, I mean, let's say you went with a telco, an internet company, and there's an element of, well, how are they powering their servers? I know recently at the AIM AGM, the Association of Independent Music, where Peter Quick from Ninja Tune made all of this the theme of his keynote. And he was talking about how it's tempting to assume that streaming music is more environmentally friendly than plastic discs. And in some ways it is, except for all the power required to stream music. And it's one of the reasons why offline listening is actually better for everybody, because you're not using quite so much of the internet if you download a track and then you keep re-listening to it. But he was talking about how quite a lot of the streaming companies now, all of their servers are powered by renewables. They've made that commitment. But of course, even if you have a streaming service who is doing what it can to use renewable energy, between its server and your iPhone is an awful lot of other servers, yeah, run by other companies. And how are they powering their servers? So even something like a telco or an internet company that you might think, oh, well, surely we could have them as an environmentally friendly partner. There is an element of what they're doing. But I thought it was interesting that Mass Attack have given out various statements about this project, as have the people at the University of Manchester. But specifically on the Liverpool show, Robert Del Naja from the band said, "We're looking forward to exploring the social and scientific solutions to the challenges we face in transitioning to a low-carbon society. This project offers an opportunity to work with new and progressive identities." By that, I think he meant companies, projects, technologies, tools. "In the planning, energy, technology and transport sectors," that's what he said. "It comes," he said, "after years of participation," so his Massive Attack, "years of participation in large-scale music events that have had questionable sponsors on the ticket and too often very little enthusiasm for meaningful change." So a little dig there at, I assume he's predominantly talking about some of the festivals they've played over the years and the sponsors of those festivals and or what those festivals are or are not doing to try and make their events more environmentally sustainable. Some festivals have been doing a lot of work in this space in recent years. That's what that conference I've been talking about is all about. All of the panels are full of festivals who have made really good, significant changes in recent years. But I think the sector at large, they are definitely right. There is still a lot of room for improvement. So yeah, as you said, they're a little bit abstract at yet as to what specifically will be happening at that show and whether it will be obvious to the attendee. I mean, presumably, if they're going to be looking at audience transportation, then that's a communications exercise. They've got to be doing stuff ahead of the gig. But it will be interesting to see specifically with that show and indeed the wider project, what it is that they've got in mind.
Well, there have been some vagaries about this, so that they haven't said exactly what touring they're going to be doing with climate scientists on board. They also haven't said exactly when this show will be. Although the Good Business Festival takes place in October, the press release about this was a little bit vague about when the show would be happening. It sort of said summer, so suggested that it wouldn't be actually part of the festival, though it's just not clear. I'm not sure they know exactly when the show's going to happen.
Among the other statements that have been issued by both Massive Attack and the climate scientists in relation to all of this activity, we had a statement from Dr. Chris Jones, who's a research fellow at Manchester University. Specifically, it's the Tyndall Centre for Climate Change Research at Manchester University, who's doing all of this work. And he said that they were looking forward to working with Massive Attack to look at sources of carbon emissions from a band's touring schedule. "Every industry has varying degrees of carbon impact to address, and we need partnerships just like this one to look at reducing carbon emissions across the board." He then sort of possibly alluded to Coldplay's decision to just stop touring.
It was very hard not to see this as a dig at Coldplay.
He then said, "It's more effective to have a sustained process of emissions reductions across the sector than for individual artists to quit live performances," is what he said. "It will likely mean a major shift in how things are done now, involving not just the band, but the rest of the business and the audience."
Yes, given that I'm not sure anyone other than Coldplay has quit live performances. I mean, who else is he talking about? So, yes, he's basically saying bands should be going on tour and taking climate scientists with them. And that's sort of protecting his job. But
Well, it also means climate scientists get a nice little junket touring the world with Massive Attack.
I'm sure all of this is being done with the best possible intentions, and I am very sorry for suggesting otherwise.
If, like me, you have a couple of global warming deniers among your Facebook echo chamber.
Do you?
I do.
Wow.
I like to have a bit of variation in my echo chamber. They are always telling me how unreliable and unscientific and disregarded climate scientists should be. So maybe this is just a junket. Maybe it's just an excuse to be rock stars for a few months. Maybe they regret having pursued a career in something as dull as climate science.
I always think, even if you don't believe that climate change is real, why shouldn't things just be nicer anyway? I mean, clearly, there are various things you can do to combat climate change that, even if you don't believe climate change is real, still make things nicer. So why not do them anyway?
One celebrity climate change campaigner. I want to say Arnold Schwarzenegger. I think it was probably Arnie. Yeah, the example he gave of that was, if you had to be locked in a sealed room with a running car that you couldn't turn off, would you rather it be a petrol car or an electric car?
Yeah.
And that was his example of, I mean, obviously there are some issues around electric cars as well, but he was basically saying, yeah, even if you don't buy the whole global warming thing or the man-made element of global warming, then, well, the example I often give is, you know, people forget that there was a moment in history in London, where we are sitting right now recording this, in the middle of the 20th century, where pollution got so bad that breathing was killing people. And
you tend to need to breathe.
And the day that they had to shut Parliament because nobody could breathe was the day when we got the Clean Air Act. And industry got chucked out of central London and we got all of that. And now, I mean, there were still issues in central London, obviously, with the car pollution. But nevertheless, you can breathe in central London and not die. So, yes.
That's quite helpful for us right now.
It is quite helpful for us right now. So let's give these climate scientists the benefit of the doubt and assume this is not a junket because they want to be pop stars and they are genuinely going to come up with some interesting research, stats, outcomes, conclusions that then Chris Martin can read and digest and then get back on the road and all those tedious Coldplay fans can go and watch tedious Coldplay play their tedious songs without worrying that they're killing the world.
Still to come, how artists are coming up with more interesting options to get their songs heard in different ways and particularly formats. But now, how radio stations are ensuring that people's songs are heard less. Because, oh, there have been some stories about songs getting banned or played and then told off for playing recently.
This is partly because the media regulator here in the UK, Ofcom, put out one of its regular reports that are always fun reading.
They are.
You should sign up to Ofcom's RSS feed or email list because they come out several times a year and basically they summarise all the complaints that have been issued against British radio stations and radio programmes on the AM/FM dial over recent months and then the conclusions that Ofcom have reached. But there are a couple of interesting ones from a music perspective in the most recent round of Ofcom reporting. And the first one is interesting because actually the same song has come up in two of these Ofcom reports in the matter of a few months.
Yeah.
And so this is relating to the song by Blue Mink called Melting Pot.
Yeah, there's a song that I only previously knew for an episode of Alan Partridge.
Where he's singing it to himself, yeah, around the travel tavern that he's staying in. So it's a song which you may not recognise the name. It's from the 1970s, the early 1970s. Mm. It was a hit at the time. It is one I think you possibly would recognise it if you heard it. You wouldn't necessarily know, oh, that's Blue Mink, that's Melting Pot. Do you think people would, or would only Alan Partridge fans recognise it?
I would only, even now, recognise it from that episode of Alan Partridge. I assumed from that show that it was a song that existed, but I could never confirm it because I'd never gone so far as to find out what it was.
But now we know because it's been played on the radio and people have complained.
But I think it's worth pointing out, it's a song that was written and recorded and performed and successful in the charts at a time when maybe it was going against the grain and it was really calling for racial harmony.
Which is slightly ironic because the reason why this song has been in two Ofcom reports this year is because of the racially insensitive language that it contains in its lyrics.
Yeah.
Which was, that was the Alan Partridge joke, wasn't it? That he was singing this happy song that had some, in the context of modern times, some slightly suspect racial slurs in there.
Yes, the line being, it's not racist because that's a race of people and a food.
That's the Alan Partridge yes. line, not the lyric in the song. So, as we say, ironically, it's a song about racial harmony, all the races, all ethnicities, all nationalities, we should all come together. It's a melting pot. That's the point of the song. But in describing which groups of people, which races, which nationalities should come together, it uses a few words which some people, many people, most people...
Let's say most people.
...today would be like, that's not really appropriate for a cheesy pop song.
Yes, so given that I believe now Chris is leading me into saying...
some of these words.
And I'm quoting from the song, Yellow Chinkies, Red Indians and Curly Latin Kinkies, all of which, no, not really, no, no. I just want to make it clear. There's lines from the song and not things that I am saying now myself.
So obviously, this is one of those stories about a song that was released in a different time.
Yeah, a very different time.
When there were words that people would have been like, oh, those are words. Whereas now, in the context of the society in which we now live, it's like, oh, that's a little bit on the edge or maybe beyond what is acceptable. So the question is, it was a hit record back in the day. People of that era, people who were buying and listening to music, pop music in that time, may remember this song. They may have fond memories of this song. Does it mean that we should be applying modern day standards to a piece of art or pop music from, what, I guess, 50 years ago we're talking about now?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the criticism, I guess, would be that you wouldn't write a song now that said, oh, we should all come together, us and the... Here are some various slang words for those other races. I mean, the song now seems like it's talking to white people saying, hey, you should get on with these weird people and not be nasty about them. But we're still going to use slurs about them and sort of leave them over there, not part of this thing we're talking about.
Now, this originally came up in Ofcom's reports when the global radio station Gold played it earlier yes. in the year. And then has more recently been back in the reports because a community radio station in Scotland called Black Diamond FM also played it. In both cases, Ofcom has upheld the complaint, the criticism of these two radio stations, but is very keen to stress that Ofcom is not in the business of censoring music or blacklisting songs. It's not saying that this song cannot be played, just that if it's gonna be played, some context should be provided before the track is played by the presenter, is basically what they were saying. So the criticism wasn't that they played the track, it was that they just played the track without actually commenting on some of the lyrics that some people might find offensive or questionable.
Yes, because if you just play that track out now, people are going to hear it and think, oh, wow, that's racist. And so it's important to say beforehand, this song was written as a song that was supposed to be anti-racism. It's just, it's a bit racist. And you need to say that before and probably after you've played it. But in both cases recently where Ofcom have had to investigate, that has not happened. The difference being with the second ruling here is that it happened the day after Ofcom's initial ruling and the presenter was aware that that had just happened.
Yes, they admitted that he was aware that Gold had already been criticised for playing this song and yet he played the song again without providing any context. The other thing that Ofcom talk about, so this community radio station in Scotland specifically targets a young demographic, whereas yeah. obviously Golden Oldie station pitches an older demographic. And this came up in both of the Ofcom reports, but it was quite amusing, wasn't it, in the first one when they were talking about Gold, because they were sort of saying, although they were criticising Gold for not providing the context that you just suggested they might have provided, I can't remember if this was Ofcom saying this or whether Global Radio, I think maybe it was Global Radio in their response, were saying that, well, Gold's listened by an older audience. And what they meant was, because it's listened by an older audience, they should understand the context of this is a 70s song and what was acceptable then. But it did kind of read like they were saying, oh, well, our listeners are all old and racist anyway, so it doesn't matter if we play racist songs. Whereas, of course, with this community radio station, they're pitching to a younger audience, so they couldn't even go with the, well, our audience are, well, either culturally knowledgeable or a bit racist and don't care.
Speaking of old songs being re-evaluated in these modern times, we have hit the festive season, which of course means the annual debate about whether or not Fairy Tale of New York, a Christmas classic, should be banned.
Yes, and the latest iteration of this long-held debate, it's sort of becoming a seasonal...
Absolutely a festive tradition.
It's like sitting down and watching The Queen or The Great Escape or whatever. This is nothing to do with Ofcom, okay? There have not been any formal complaints yet about Fairy Tale of New York being back on the radio. No radio stations have banned it, but one DJ on one BBC local radio station has said that he's not going to play it on his show. But more than that, well, A, he gave quite an amusing rant when justifying why he wasn't going to play it on his show. But he was also calling on the rest of radio, so not Ofcom, but every other radio station and radio DJ in the country, to join him in saying that Fairytale of New York does not belong on a radio station Christmas 2019.
Yes, so this is Alex Dyke, who presents on BBC Radio Solent, and he initially tweeted about it. This is where he was attempting to get all of radio to join him in this ban, which possibly was optimistic. But in that rant, he described the song as an offensive pile of downmarket chav bilge, which I think chav was deemed an offensive term that shouldn't be used about 15 years ago. So he deleted that tweet, but he still ranted about it on his radio show, where he still described it as downmarket bilge. He did drop the chav when he got to air.
Yeah, he said, "I hope I'm not going to ruin your Christmas." I mean, I really like this song, but I think I could live without one show on the local BBC station in Southampton playing it. It's not going to ruin anyone's Christmas. But anyway, "I hope I'm not going to ruin your Christmas, but I have decided that I am no longer comfortable with playing Fairytale of New York by the Pogues and Kirsty MacColl. I think Christmas songs should be about excited children, toys, Christmas trees, snowy streets, ski lodges."
Yeah.
I mean, is that Christmassy?
Yeah.
I think he's got Last Christmas video on his mind there, hasn't he?
Yeah.
With ski lodges. Yeah. But they don't even sing about ski lodges in that song. It's just the videos at a ski lodge. Reindeer.
Yep.
Wrapping paper. Who's ever written a song about wrapping paper?
I'm sure there's a song with wrapping paper in it.
Do you think someone's done a cheesy rap about wrapping paper?
Yes.
Probably. Santa Claus. There is a song about Santa Claus. And that reminds me. Have you ever heard that South Park song, which is Jesus and Santa at a sort of a... You should Google it, it's really funny. It's from the South Park Christmas album, and it's Jesus and Santa at a cheesy jazz club, each singing songs. And so Santa sings a Santa song, and then Jesus sings a Jesus song, and then Santa... But there's a lot more Jesus songs than Santa songs. So I seem to remember in the end, Santa has to sing Rio by Duran Duran. Anyway... Don't know why I went on that tangent. Try and Google it.
So those would all be fine.
That would be fine, even though it's on the incredibly offensive South Park Christmas album. It would tick all the boxes.
What else is there?
Peace on Earth he wants.
And family.
And love.
And love. I mean, that's quite a long list, but it does actually cut out quite a lot of Christmas songs.
So, I don't know. Does Mistletoe and Wine have all of that in it? Probably does somewhere, doesn't it?
It probably does, but I mean, famously, Christmas number ones are often songs that don't actually have anything about Christmas in them, but then become Christmas. I mean, Stay by E17.
Yes.
A classic Christmas song about suicide.
It is. They put some... He doesn't bells say, in it, didn't they, that made it sound a little bit Christmassy.
But he hasn't said he's banning that.
No, he hasn't banned that. And of course, your favourite thing, I know, we've talked about this before on Setlist, I think, is putting on a Christmas number ones playlist over Christmas lunch, just cheekily waiting for Gilling in the Name to come on.
Yep.
Hopefully as the Christmas pudding arrives.
Oh no, I like it to come on as it did one year while everyone was having their post-lunch nap.
Really loud and sweary. But anyway, that's what he wants. The Pogues' Fairytale of New York, we can confirm, does not fulfil that criteria.
No.
And more than that, he doesn't like the lyrics. "You're a bum, you're a punk, you're a slut on junk." He doesn't like that.
Nope.
Nor does he like... Now, obviously, this is the line that usually causes controversy, isn't it? The "you scumbag, you maggot, you cheap, lousy faggot" is the one that has come up before. Indeed, at one point, the BBC, on most of their stations, had edited that line.
They bleeped it.
They bleeped
or silenced it, but then they retracted that.
And they put the original version back on. And it's interesting, isn't it, with this song, because like with Melting Pot, where you've got lyrics that were possibly acceptable in 1970 but aren't now, what's interesting about this song is it's not when the song was written, it's the fact that the song is set in the past.
Yes.
So even when the song was written, some of these words would have been offensive, but the point was we're telling a story here about two... not very nice characters. And I think one of the reasons why a lot of people like this song is it's not a Christmas song, it's just set at Christmas. It's because the Pogues tell stories in their songs. And so this is a story set in the past that happens to happen at Christmas about two not very nice people having a really horrible argument. And that's why people like it, because it's sort of like the music's very Christmassy and it's set at Christmas, but then the lyrics aren't Christmassy, and that's why people like it. They like the sort of the juxtaposition and the contrast.
Yes, and as the controversy around this song grew last year, Shane McGowan actually put out a statement saying, I wrote this song, is it set in the 40s?
Something like that, yeah.
It was the 30s or 40s, and he said, I was trying to write an authentic character, and this is the language that she would have used in that time. And so that's why those words are there. I know they're offensive words, but they're intentionally offensive because they're trying to be authentic. He also said that given that this song is being played out as just a Christmas song, and people don't necessarily know the context of it, he doesn't mind if the offensive word is bleeped when it goes out on radio, but he doesn't want to get drawn into the debate himself.
Also, I think it's because they are both playing characters in essence when they're singing this. Shane McGowan and Kirsty MacColl. It's also why most cover versions of this song are freaking awful. because I think Shane McGowan and Kirsty MacColl really play those characters, even though they're just singing songs in a call and response song, but they both, something about the way they deliver the lines works as the characters that they're trying to portray.
Yes.
And nobody who's covered this song has ever managed to pull that off.
No, and I mean, covers often change the offensive lyrics as well, but they're singing the song rather than playing the characters. And that's where those covers fall down. That's why this song endures, and there's never been a cover that's usurped it.
Exactly. So anyway, if you're a listener to Alex Dyke's show on BBC Radio 7, you won't be hearing that song. But hey, we're in the Spotify age. Why are you listening to local radio anyway? And the BBC were keen to point out that this is one guy on one radio station. This was Alex's decision, said the BBC. There is no ban, they were keen to add. And then this next sentence, it's like, we have a strict music policy that we expect to be followed. So I don't know if that means they're going to put it onto his playlist on his show. I don't know how much control he has over what songs he plays or whether or not he's told what to play and they're going to try and put it on there to annoy him. I don't know. But anyway, I think we can probably cope with one radio show on one local radio station not playing that song, given that anybody can access it on Spotify or YouTube and it will be playing in lots of other places over the next couple of weeks.
We have had one other story in the last week about offensive music on the radio, where I don't think there was any question about whether or not it should have been played.
Not even the radio station that played it was trying to justify it. So this is back in the Ofcom report that we mentioned earlier. It was another community radio station. So very around community radio stations, most of their presenters are volunteers. They're doing it as out of passion for love. And so, yes, it was a sort of urban hip-hop show on a Doncaster-based community radio station. And apparently how it went was that the guy who was presenting got called away. There was a family emergency. He was away on the phone. He just grabbed a mixtape. I mean, actually, most, I don't know about community radio stations. Obviously, most sort of full-on commercial radio stations or BBC stations, they have an emergency tape, don't they? Which, I mean, usually is in case there's a fire alarm and they have to evacuate and they stick the emergency tape on. But he just grabbed a mixtape that he had, left it playing while he had to deal with the call. It had tracks from the likes of Kano, Old Dirty Bastard, Mystical, Snoop Dogg, Kanye, 50 Cent, Missy Elliott was on there. And it was an early evening show going on this community radio station. And across the mix, there was one hoe, one motherfucker, two dicks. I actually did the maths because the Ofcom report just listed them by track.
Right.
So I put them in a spreadsheet. I did some work here.
A spreadsheet?
Well, it was the easiest way to count
them. A swearing spreadsheet.
Where were we? Two dicks, two pussies. So good gender balance. Six bitches, six bullshits, eight shits, 16 fucks. And then, I mean, you know, this is a comment on sort of hip hop and urban music. 23 uses of the N-word across. So by far, probably the most offensive word that was in there was the one that was by far the most frequently used. But I mean, you know, it was a hip hop mixtape that hadn't been edited for the radio. That's not really that big a surprise.
The presenter did say he put it on not realising how sweary it would be. I mean, he must have had an idea.
Well, maybe he, because obviously some radio stations, they make radio edits, don't they, of all these tracks with the swear words taken out so that usually you can't. Sometimes some Kanye tracks on there. Well, when they take the swearing out, it's just basically an instrumental with an occasional word on top. So maybe he thought they were radio edits, or maybe he didn't even really know what he was putting on. Anyway,
he was doing it at speed, and the presenter did immediately resign from the station. He didn't wait around to see what the Ofcom decision was.
So the Ofcom decision was, yeah, you really shouldn't have played that. The radio station's response was, yeah, we really shouldn't have played that. the DJ's response was, yeah, we really shouldn't have played that.
Given that some of the hardest Ofcom decisions come when a radio station plays maybe two swear words in an hour, that was quite a long list. I mean, you made a spreadsheet that suggests that there was quite a lot of swearing.
That's how much swearing there was. So anyway, there we go. It's been an interesting week for debates around what we should and should not play on good old-fashioned radio. Will someone please think about the kids? Oh, they don't listen to radio. So it doesn't matter. Let them have whatever they like.
And finally this week, Christmas is coming. You need to buy some stuff for your family. How about something music related? But these days, you could buy someone a CD. Do they have a CD player? Who knows? You need something else. And that is why there are plenty of artists here to help you right out with that.
Yes, probably because Christmas is looming. In the last week, we've had a couple of records being announced where interesting things were going on.
Well, you know what? The first one we're going to discuss, I think they're not expecting that to be a Christmas present.
Yes,
I'm going to go out on a limb there.
Well, this is the donut that you've already alluded to.
Yes.
On this edition of Setlist. And I sort of feel that earlier on you were alluding, like, it literally was a form. You would somehow be able to play the music on the donut.
I know that's not the case. Everyone knows that's not the case, but it's funny to pretend that it is.
Because there wasn't there somebody releasing music on biscuits and you actually could play the biscuits?
No.
Or did I remember that wrong?
Oreos put out a biscuit tin where you could put a biscuit on it.
Oh, but the music was in the little device.
It didn't really play. Someone did release, in fact, this may have happened more than once, at least one record has been released on playable chocolate.
I think that's what I'm thinking
Obviously,
about.
Obviously, that chocolate melted.
That's what I'm thinking about, yes. But this is Robin Richards, who you probably know better for his band Dutch Uncles. Mm-hmm. He's got a solo release coming out. And he has announced that alongside the record, there is an official donut that's coming out with the record. And you can buy the vinyl and the donut in a pack. But why official donut? What happened here is once the record had been made, he went to his favourite donut cafe in Manchester and said, would you create a donut inspired and influenced by my music? So this isn't just any old donut. This is a donut that has been specifically created to be appropriate to the track that he is releasing.
Yes, so he's got a new EP coming out called Castel, which is out now as you hear this. You can still buy the donut at the moment. If you're listening to the show as it comes out, you've got a few days left to buy it. It's being sold at a Welsh cafe in Manchester called Shop Shop. I think that's how you say it. Shop is spelt differently both occasions, but I think it's called Chop Shop. The owner of that cafe, Ewan Roberts, said, when we were initially asked to respond to Robin's EP in donut form, I thought this was a very strange request. Luckily, we're also very strange.
Well, they are a Welsh cafe in Manchester. Manchester's not in Wales. That's a bit
true.
Strange to start with. I mean, they're Welsh and they make Welsh sort of influenced food.
That's true, but I mean, not by that logic. I mean, I've been to an Indian restaurant in various towns
for
in the
some
UK,
reason, the
and
Welsh,
that's even further away.
For some reason, a Welsh cafe in Manchester seems more odd than an Indian restaurant in Birmingham, but whatever.
Anyway, he says, in response, we present a coffee and cardamom custard-filled donut with a caramel glaze. We've taken inspiration from the Estonian dessert Kringle, which is a sweet yeasted bread flavoured with cardamom. I mean, that's weirder, isn't it, than being just Welsh?
That is true.
This pairs well with coffee, he adds. I mean, coffee, that's from miles away, isn't it?
Well, it depends, isn't it?
It's not Welsh.
It probably isn't Welsh.
But I'd take a donut with coffee. I'm willing to take that hit for the team. If I have to eat a donut and coffee together, I'll do it.
So you can just buy this donut on its own with
yes.
a cup of coffee, or you can buy it with the record, which you should do because it's part of the release, and then you can see how the donut and the track compare. That's the point of this project. Although you can only do this in this Welsh cafe in Manchester.
Yes, so. And you have until, I mean, as this goes out, you have until Friday.
So you are either in Manchester, in which case I think you should go and do it.
Absolutely.
Or you're incredibly keen and you're going to travel to Manchester in order to taste this donut and listen to the track. There is also an in-store performance, but have we missed that?
We've missed that, yes.
We've missed the in-store performance.
It happened, but there's no point talking about it now.
No point talking about it now. But we said there were some other interesting format decisions or merch add-ons, bundles, I guess. We were talking about bundles last week, weren't we? to announce this week. I mean, first of all, we don't know a huge amount about this, do we? But Efter Klang are releasing a new four-track EP, and will there have socks somehow bundled into this?
Yeah, so Efter Klang released an album recently, which I cannot pronounce the name of because it's Danish. It's their first Danish language album. It's a very good album. You should go and listen to it. But they've just put out a four-track EP of, I think, songs recorded in the same sessions as the album. And with Christmas coming up, what's the classic Christmas gift? Socks. And so they're releasing this EP as a sock gift pack. I mean, you get the socks which have the EP artwork on them.
But the socks aren't musical.
I assume that there's some sort of barcode on the tag.
So you listen to the music on your phone and you wear the socks.
Yes.
We think that's how it works.
The other possibly more interesting.
Well, it's certainly the one that our report on the website was getting a lot of traffic.
It really was because, I mean, I think... To our benefit, we put information about this on the internet, and JME's new album, not on the internet. I mean, he's gone to fairly great lengths to keep it off the internet.
Yeah, so a new album from JME, it's called Grime MC. Yeah, and so the big gimmick, if you like, of this release is nothing online. It's not on Spotify, it's not on Apple, it's not on YouTube. If you want this record, you will have to go to a record shop. You can't, well, you could buy it online, but if you're in the UK, there's a reason why you wouldn't want to. You have to go to a record shop, remember them, go to a record shop and buy it in a physical format. And that is the only way that you can access his new album. We're cynics. We suspect it will ultimately arrive online. But
I think JME is the type of artist who would just say, no, I'm never going to put it online.
I mean, obviously, it will unofficially arrive online.
Oh, of course. It's online right now. I mean, let's not...
But the cynic bit was, I think ultimately it will be officially released online. But at the moment, yes, you have to go to record shop and buy it. If you're outside the UK, you can mail order it. You can get it through the post, but only in physical format. But you can't do that in the UK. And you could say, well, hang on, if you can buy it off his website for mail order, what's to stop me doing that in the UK? But he really wants you to go to your local record shop, so he's thought of that.
Yes, only the CD is available for international fans, and you go on his website and you can just order it like you would any mail order record. But if you think, well, I'm in the UK and I can't be bothered going outside, I'm going to order it on his website. Yeah, if you put in a UK address for delivery, it adds £1,000 to your shipping charges, which, I mean, you've really going to want to not go to a record shop for this.
Or be very rich.
Yes. I mean, I don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but I have this album on vinyl and I ordered it online from a record shop and I think they charged me £4 for delivery. But let's ignore that.
Sneaky. Well, I'm going to work out what record shop that was. Shop them to JME and they won't be included in this next support your local record shop scheme.
It's every record shop. They've all got an online store. I tried different ones to get the cheapest postage.
He's trying to help you, record shops, and you're not helping yourself.
I still bought it from a record shop.
You did. That is true.
My local record shop didn't have it.
Your local record shop didn't have it.
Yeah. So I bought it online.
Oh, well. He's trying to help you. And I mean, you should embrace these things, record shops. You should embrace what JME is doing, because otherwise, if you don't embrace things like this, within 5 years, you'll all be selling donuts. But maybe musical donuts, and that will be fine.
Maybe, yes. But it was an interesting thing. I mean, there's a gimmicky element to this. But actually, if you go and look back, he's been planning this for such a long time. He hasn't used social media since last year. And there's a YouTube video in which he writes, he was doing a tour of record shops to promote this album. And there is a video on YouTube where he plays a bit of the album on a record player and writes down the tour dates on a blackboard. And so in terms of official channels, that's the only place you can really get to hear a bit of the music. But basically, he's gone dark on the internet to the point that actually he did promotional events for the record in July. And, you know, normally you would preview your music with a YouTube video. He did events in cinemas where fans could apply for tickets, come and hear some of the music and see videos on the big screen. And then afterwards they could meet JME and have their photo taken with him. But he was so keen to keep everything off the internet. The only photos you could have were on a Polaroid camera that he had brought with him.
So yes, your selfie was on a good old fashioned Polaroid, which I guess you could then snap and share on Instagram. But that wouldn't be the point. The point was you hold your Polaroid photo, you treasure your Polaroid photo, and like JME himself, you don't get any of this on the big bad World Wide Web.
Yes, and so, I mean, we should, on that note, probably take ourselves off the internet right now, by which I mean we've run out of time. We have to go and leave this studio. So that is it for this episode of Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an unlimited production.